This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. ByteDance, the Chinese parent company of video sharing app TikTok, filed a petition late on Tuesday with a U.S. appeals court challenging a Trump administration order set to take effect on Thursday, requiring it to divest TikTok. President Donald Trump, in an August 14th order, directed ByteDance to divest the app within 90 days. In a statement, TikTok said, facing continual new requests and no clarity on whether our proposed solutions would be accepted, we've requested the 30-day extension that is expressly permitted in the August 14th order. It added, without an extension in hand, we have no choice but to file a petition in court to defend our rights. The White House and Treasury declined to comment. Justice Department did not immediately comment. The Trump administration contends TikTok poses a national security concerns as the personal data of U.S. users could be obtained by China's government. TikTok, which has over 100 million U.S. users, denies the allegations. A Canadian man charged with killing 10 people and the attempted murder of 16 in a 2018 van attack in Toronto told a court he should not be held criminally responsible as the five-week trial kicked off on Tuesday. Alec Manassian spoke to the court via Zoom. He has not denied his role in the attack, but said he is entering a plea of not criminally responsible on all counts. The prosecutor said psychological and psychiatric experts will be called to present evidence that the attack was, in his words, planned and deliberate. To keep up on this and all the stories we're covering at VOA, you can visit our website, voanews.com. From Washington, you're listening to VOA News. The United States on Monday reported more than 1 million new cases of COVID-19 in just the first 10 days of November. The U.S. has recorded over 10 million cases of COVID-19. That's the highest of any country in the world. And the statistics are according to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. Midwestern states are being hit the hardest, with hospitalization rates in the region reaching record highs. The COVID-19 tracking project said more than 59,000 people were hospitalized nationwide on Monday. On the same day that the U.S. recorded this spike, two U.S. drug companies announced developments in the fight against the virus. Pfizer announced that its experimental vaccine was 90% effective in preventing the virus in participants without evidence of prior infection. U.S.-based drug maker Eli Lilly and Canadian-based biotech firm AbCellera announced a new antibody drug known as bamlanivimab. It is part of a class of treatments known as monoclonal antibodies, which are made to act as immune cells that scientists hope can fight off the virus. The antibody therapy is similar to one given to U.S. President Donald Trump after he tested positive for COVID-19 early last month. The FDA has approved the antibody drug for people 12 and older who are at risk of developing a serious form of COVID-19. In Washington, U.S. Health Secretary Alex Azar says if pharmaceutical company Pfizer submits its interim COVID-19 vaccine to health regulators as quickly as expected, the U.S. government now expects to begin vaccinations in December. Pfizer on Monday said its vaccine was 90% effective against COVID-19. Azar says he anticipates more vaccines from other companies soon. The news comes as the U.S. surpassed 10 million total COVID-19 cases, including the more than 100,000 new cases on Monday. COVID-19 infections have spiked in other parts of the world, including in Europe, where some governments have instituted lockdown measures to slow the spread of the virus. Globally, the number of confirmed cases is more than 50 million, with 1.2 million deaths. Authorities in Afghanistan say an intelligence-led security operation has killed a key al-Qaeda leader in a western region close to the Iranian border. The Afghan spy agency identified the slain man as Mohammed Hanif, also known as Abdullah, and said he was linked to the terror network's regional affiliate, al-Qaeda, in the Indian subcontinent. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. You're listening to VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America and James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union calls for cessation of hostilities in Ethiopia-Tigray conflict, but some say the die is cast.
There is no question of negotiation at this point, because what happened is beyond repairable. They have ignored the entire Ethiopian nations and nationalities, which is a crime.
There's a call for a broad-based national consultation in the DRC. Rising political tensions in Ivory Coast sent thousands fleeing. The ECOWAS Court of Justice calls for reinstatement of an impeached Liberian Supreme Court justice. And Tanzania's main opposition presidential candidate has left the country.
I am in Addis Ababa International Airport right now. I managed to get out of Tanzania after the negotiations between the Western diplomats in Dar es Salaam and the government of Tanzania secured safe passage for me.
And slam poets convene in Bamako for a festival. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African Union has called for the immediate cessation of hostilities in the conflict between Ethiopia and its northern Tigray region. In a statement, African Union Commission Chairperson Moussa Faki Mahamat also called for a dialogue to seek a peaceful solution and for both sides to respect human rights and the protection of civilians. The appeal comes as reports Tuesday say Ethiopians were fleeing into neighboring Sudan. Berhane Mewa is an Ethiopian business person in the U.S. state of Maryland. He says the conflict has reached a point of no return and that the Tigrayan authorities are to blame.
It is really very saddening that it is escalated to this level, but things were going to that direction. What I could say, it started by the TPLF regime. It all started from their side. That's what I believe, because from the very beginning, when they go back to Tigray from Addis Ababa, after they were defeated politically, they were given chance and opportunity to align themselves with the will and conditions of the Ethiopian, but rather they continued to incite violence in the various parts of the country, including hate-mongering. It was very much tolerated by the prime minister. Amazingly, there were a lot of Ethiopians who were asking for action. They were not questioned about the crimes they did. And then further, they went going against the constitution and trying to advocate about the election. And they escalated that issue to this level. The election issue was a constitutional issue. Everybody wants to go to election, including the government and the people. But the condition, the global condition, did not allow. And that was agreed upon by 90% of the people.
Now, there are unconfirmed reports that Eritrea had sent troops to support Ethiopian federal forces. Now, if this is true, what do you think this means for the conflict?
Actually, I don't believe that Eritrea should involve in the Ethiopian affairs. And I don't think it will do that. Probably it might reinforce its border. And for that, they are the ones who are responsible because they dismantled the Ethiopian National Force in the north, which was supposed to protect the territory. Thanks to the prime minister, the condition between Ethiopia and Eritrea is relatively good. Otherwise, it would have been very dangerous for Ethiopia if there was tension between Ethiopia and Eritrea.
Prime Minister Abe is a Nobel laureate. We understand the African Union, IGAD, has been asking the prime minister for negotiation or for dialogue. And it seems that the prime minister is ignoring that. Can there be any way out of this?
Yeah, I think he's being a laureate, a Nobel Prize laureate winner. It should not affect his protection of the country. He has a responsibility to protect the country. And what has happened is the TPLF force physically attacked the Ethiopian force. And he is responsible to take care of the country and bring these people to justice. So there is no question of negotiation at this point, because what they have done is beyond repairable, damaged the integrity of the country. They have ignored the entire Ethiopian nations and nationalities, which is a crime.
Berhane Mewa is an Ethiopian business person in the U.S. state of Maryland. Tanzania's main opposition presidential candidate, Tundu Lissu, has left the country for Europe following a contentious October 28 presidential election that the opposition said was fraudulent. The Tanzanian government responded to a planned opposition demonstration to demand fresh elections and arrested several opposition leaders for inciting people to demonstrate. Lissu told VOA Tuesday before boarding his flight from Addis Ababa International Airport that he was allowed to leave the country after negotiations between Western diplomats and the Tanzanian government secured him a safe passage. He said he was forced to leave because his life is in danger.
I am in Addis Ababa International Airport right now. I managed to get out of Tanzania after the negotiations between the Western diplomats in Dar es Salaam and the government of Tanzania secured safe passage for me.
There was a report that you were seeking political asylum, I said, with the German embassy or what? What is the truth?
I did not seek political asylum. I just ran for my life because the police and the security apparatus of President Magufuli were closing in on me, and I had to run. And the German diplomats got me out of harm's way by affording me a safe place to stay for about a week, more than a week, actually, from Monday last week to early today. So I've been at German ambassador's residence for 8 days until today.
You said you are on your way to Europe. Could you tell us what is the purpose of your trip?
Well, number one is what I've said all along, that my life was in danger after the election. What passed for an election was called out. Then we called for mass protests. I received messages that I was a marked man and I had to run. Therefore, I went to the German embassy and now I'm on my way to Belgium because I cannot stay in Tanzania. It is too unsafe for me.
A member of the opposition has fled to Kenya, and there was a report that he has asked for asylum or the permission to stay in the country. What can you tell us in terms of what's going on in Tanzania?
Well, the level of repression has absolutely skyrocketed. Hundreds of our people countrywide have been arrested. They're being charged with very serious economic offenses, which are completely trumped up. These are political persecution. And therefore, Mr. Godbless Lema, the former MP for Arusha, has had to run for his life, like myself. It is not entirely surprising because the level of repression under President Magufuli has spiked the fraudulent election of 2 weeks ago.
Mr. Lissu, personally, how are you feeling?
Well, I did not want to leave the country. I certainly wasn't planning to leave until next month when I was due to be in Brussels for medical treatment. I have an appointment with my doctors at the University of Leuven Hospital on the 20th of December. So I wasn't planning to leave Tanzania until the 18th of December, but now I'm forced to basically run for my life, and it makes me feel sad. But on the other hand, this enforced departure affords me the opportunity to continue the fight on a different front. This struggle has to be fought on several fronts. Domestically, it is becoming very difficult to carry out the democratic struggles, and therefore we have to open the international front. We have to engage the international community, talk to countries that have always been friendly to Tanzania, to seek their intervention, because it is becoming literally impossible to carry out democratic opposition within the country.
Tundu Lissu is the presidential candidate of Tanzania's main opposition, Chadema Party. He was speaking with us from Ethiopia's Addis Ababa International Airport. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, President Felix Tshisekedi continues his consultations with different segments of the society in preparation for the 2023 presidential election. The consultation will produce the next elections commission that will supervise the election. But Emery Damien Kawira, president of the Congolese Coalition for Transition, says the consultation is missing the key players of the democratic crisis in the DRC.
We are seeing that Tshisekedi is on to make electoral coalition, but we cannot see which solution we can find without the real protagonist of the crisis. This is Fayulu, he's not there. Vital Kamerhe, who makes coalition with Kamerhe, is not there. And the CCT, our coalition, is not there. And so that we are saying that the solution of this legitimacy crisis in our country is to go to the national dialogue, which will allow us to have the national pact to prepare a new election, which will allow to Congolese people to put authorities which will have legitimacy. That now, you know, that legitimacy of Tshisekedi is not accepted. He is a president without legitimacy.
So President Tshisekedi is in a coalition with former President Kabila. The president wants to appoint a new elections commission for the 2023 presidential election.
But you know that we need to find a root problem. The root problem is Tshisekedi himself, he don't have legitimacy. And the current problem in our country here, it's about legitimacy of institutions from the president of the republic, a parliament, and all the territorial institutions, the local institutions. All of them have been elected with corruption. So that's why we say we cannot remake the same. We need not to sit down together to tell Kabila, this is your mistake, Tshisekedi, this is your mistake, Fayulu, this is your mistake. And together, we found a global solution which will allow us to organize now the good election, which will help and allow Congolese people to go to elect their own authorities. But if we go with this new rhythm of Tshisekedi, it will be like we take the same system, the same method, and we will have the same problem.
The consultations that the president is having now, he is talking to almost everyone in the Congolese society. He wants to also talk to the religious leaders. Isn't that inclusive?
It's not inclusive because the real protagonists are Vital Kamerhe, who makes with him the agreement in Nairobi for making the electoral coalition. He's in the prison for the fake justice case. The second is Martin Fayulu, who until now is saying that he's claiming his victory to the last presidential election. The third is our side, all the organization personalities who told to them everyone that the fake election will not allow us to resolve this crisis. So all of those three parties, we must sit down and talking through each to other and to find a global solution.
Emery Damien Kalwira is the president of the Congolese Coalition. He was speaking with us from Brussels. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 11th. The United Nations Refugee Agency says there is a significant increase in the number of people fleeing Ivory Coast to neighboring countries in the wake of the country's controversial October 31st presidential election. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 8,000 Ivorians have fled rising political tensions in Ivory Coast. That is up from 3,200 in just 1 week. The UN Refugee Agency says it fears the number will continue to grow as ongoing violence shows no signs of abating. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baloch says 7,500 refugees have fled to Liberia. The others, he says, have sought refuge in Burkina Faso, Ghana, Guinea, and Togo.
Over 60% of arrivals are children, some of whom arrived unaccompanied or separated from their parents. Older people and pregnant women have also fled, most carrying just few belongings and little or to no food or money at all.
Alassane Ouattara won a third presidential term by an overwhelming margin of 94%. Opposition parties boycotted the election, calling his bid for a third term illegal under the Constitution's two-term limit. Ouattara has argued the two-term limit does not apply to him under a new constitution adopted in 2016. Dozens of people reportedly have been killed in election-related violence. Baloch tells VOA, fear of violence is driving the current exodus.
This brings back bad memories from 2011, the presidential elections then, which claimed the lives of 3,000 people and forced over 300,000 to flee. So these people who are coming, they're not mentioning currently being targeted or them being attacked, but it is the fear of violence.
Bala says most refugees in Liberia wish to remain close to the border and return home as soon as the situation stabilizes. In the meantime, the UNHCR is increasing aid for the refugees. Bala says the agency is planning to airlift essential relief items for up to 10,000 refugees in Liberia. He says aid workers are racing to distribute humanitarian aid, including food and cash, and to provide water, sanitation, and shelter. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS's Community Court of Justice, has ordered the Liberian government to reinstate former Supreme Court Justice Kabina Janin and pay him $200,000 as reparation for what the court calls moral prejudice suffered in the violation of his rights. Associate Justice Janin was impeached in March 2019 for granting a writ of prohibition petition brought by petroleum dealers in Liberia to stop the government from collecting a 25-cent road tax. He argued during the impeachment that his decision was endorsed by the full bench of the Supreme Court. ECOWAS Court President Edward Mwako Asante says Associate Justice Jane was denied a fair hearing and his dignity as a Supreme Court justice.
The conclusion is that the judge was unjustly or wrongfully removed by impeachment from the Supreme Court of Justice. True to our word, the pleadings from the Republic of Liberia actually even stated somewhere that it was a political decision and therefore the court shouldn't have jurisdiction to override their political decision. Reading political meanings into it, we didn't want this kind of impunity to happen for politicians to have a way because the position of judges should be insulated all the time such that politicians should not have the penchant of removing them at any time they wish because maybe they may not be singing their songs and all that. And clearly, during the pre-impeachment stages, the proceedings are such that the respondent, that's the removed justice, was not invited. He was not listened to because that is where the actual charges are formulated. And therefore, by law, even their own procedures, due process, he should have been invited or his defense actually should have been taken there for the House of Representatives to know, ascertain whether or not they should even dismiss the entire impeachment proceedings or to proceed. That was not done, and therefore they concluded virtually on the charges that had been laid against him. And the court found that these were seriously against his right to fair hearing. And therefore the court had no choice but to say that they had infringed on his right, violated his right to work, right to fair hearing, and even right to his dignity as a Supreme Court judge.
Justice, as you know, I think we've talked before, and I think the Liberian government has said that your court did not have jurisdiction over this particular case. I'm thinking about how enforceable you think that this ruling can be.
Well, we did a two-pronged judgment or ruling. We said that they should reinstate him. For the first time, we have said that. And in the absence of their inability to reinstate him because we are aware they instantly appointed another judge in his place as soon as he was removed. And in the absence of that, they should pay him all his salaries and allowances as if he was on duty up to the time that he retired at 70, as they do, and then proceed to also pay him his pension. Talking about the enforceability, the Liberian government has not appointed even the focal person through whom judgments can be enforced. And then they have also showed a certain posture that they do not actually respect the court's judgment. But then we will keep fighting and we'll keep publicizing, as you have done. Now it's on VOA. It's going all over the place. Liberian government is doing this. They are removing judges and all that. And we are going to serve the president of the ECOWAS Commission, whose duty it is to ensure that states comply with the judgments of the court. And we're also giving them 6 months within which to do that. And otherwise, if legally ECOWAS is working and working well, they could even apply sanctions against Liberia for non-compliance with the judgments of the court.
Justice Edward Mwako Asante is the president of the ECOWAS Community Court of Justice. He was speaking with us from Abuja, Nigeria. The West African nation of Mali usually makes news because of a growing Islamist insurgency and an August coup that are seen as threatening regional stability. But Mali is also known in the region for its music and cultural festivals. This year's annual Slam Poetry Festival has attracted artists from the region. Reporter Anne Riesenberg in Bamako followed one young Malian poet who is bucking stereotypes in a conservative nation.
Mali this year struggled with an Islamist insurgency, a worldwide pandemic, and an August military coup, all of which left most cultural events in the West African nation in shambles. But Mali's annual International Festival of Slam and Humor, FISH, was merely delayed until November, after a post-coup curfew was lifted. 23-year-old Malian Aisha Diarra first learned of competitive performance poetry, slam poetry, when her high school held a contest. She has been a slam poet ever since and competes at FISH every year. Diarra sees her art as a form of activism to highlight the struggles of Malian women and girls. Sitting on a graffiti-covered rooftop in Bamako, she says many of the topics in her poems are considered taboo in conservative Mali. Diarra says that people often think the subjects she writes about in her lyrics are too bold. When I talk about circumcision of young girls, she says, it is generally a taboo subject in Africa. Others congratulate me, says Diarra, because there are many who do not dare to venture there. Slam poetry is a relatively new music scene in Mali, a country with deep musical traditions that is seen as a cultural crossroads in Africa. Slam poetry first appeared in Mali in 2006, years after it gained popularity in the United States, and FISH started in 2014. The annual festival is run by Malian group Akradatoire, founded by one of Mali's first slam poets, Aziz Kone. Kone explains how he came up with a theme for this year's festival: peace and social cohesion.
Comme vous le savez, tout le monde le sait, depuis 2012, le Mali est fragilisé par une crise.
As you know, says Kone, everyone knows it. Since 2012, Mali has been weakened by a security crisis, by a social crisis. So we saw that it is important for us today to hold this festival, he says, in the name of peace and social cohesion. Just days before the festival, the region's former colonial power, France, launched airstrikes in central Mali that killed more than 50 jihadists. Mali has been struggling against an Islamist insurgency spreading in the Sahel region, along with thousands of UN and French troops. Anger over the ongoing conflict fueled mass protests that led the military in August to oust President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. Despite the unrest, the festival and Mali's slam poets have seen their support base grow. Jelimari Sissoko is an executive member of the Malian Federation of Artists. He teaches the kora, a West African string instrument, to students at the National Arts Institute.
Donc oui, les slameurs, c'est pour nous, c'est des musiciens à part entière.
Sissoko says the slam poets are considered full-fledged musicians. He says they accept them as being musicians. At the festival, slam poet Diarra performed on stage for the first time in nearly a year.
C'est la joie que j'ai au cœur. C'est comme un enfant qui savait marcher.
I have joy in my heart, she says, like a child who could walk, suddenly fell ill, and could not walk. Later, the doctor tells him that he will walk again, says Diarra. You can imagine the joy, she says. So I have this joy. Undeterred by the region's ongoing conflict and unrest at home, Mali's slam poets, like Diarra, are passionate about their art and a better future for their country. Annie Riesenberg for VOA News, Bamako.
And that's it for this Wednesday, November 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.